This is the Political Show and Tell, a podcast revealing the personalities of people in political thinking. I'm your host, Tanya Lesenska. Kadri Leek is a senior policy analyst at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Before that, she used to be a foreign news editor and editor-in-chief in two Estonian outlets, and her main area of expertise is Russia. What I've always found interesting about her is her style of writing, which is unconventional for the policy realm. It has always managed to transport me to Russia, to the very room or street where the events were taking place. Stay tuned to learn more about how she developed her style and where she used to sneak in when she first started visiting Moscow.
So why I went to study journalism, I think it was a mixture of things. Probably there was some creative ambition in it. It was about writing, and I thought that I want to try. But secondly, in the Soviet Union, in its waning years, creative class was the popular thing to be, because that's where everything was happening. That's where you could meet the best people, but that's also where politics was happening. I didn't think I was drawn to politics at the time, but actually I suspect I was, because arts were the place where you could speak about politics. You would put your thoughts in between the lines, in theater reviews or writings about literature, and people would pick it up. They would know how to read it in the conditions of Soviet censorship. And when the Perestroika started, then actually journalism was the driving force. Journalism was the place where things were happening, where the whole debate about what's right, what's wrong, what the future should be like was taking place. And I also guess I liked the people who had set up the Department of Journalism at Tartu. And it was known to be a lively and free-thinking place. And yet again, in Soviet times, you know, university, it could be very different. You could end up in some orthodox, stiff place that was void of energy and where you wouldn't meet the sort of company you'd want. Or you could end up somewhere different. And I think Department of Journalism at Tartu at the time was really good in the sense that it was a small place, very tightly connected. Everyone knew everyone. And our teachers really tried to give us proper education and teach us to think. And they strayed from Soviet orthodoxy happily. I mean, the course may have been titled History of Soviet Journalism, but what we actually studied and discussed may have been something quite different. So I guess that's why I went to study journalism, but I had very vague ideas as to what my career would be like. And it couldn't have been otherwise. Had I tried to plan something, I would have failed miserably.
You talk about journalism as a driving force and also about what I would call nowadays the bravery of your professors at university to teach you something that was not in the books, so to speak. So I wanted to know, what is journalism for you?
It has been different things. I think, as I said, when I started It probably I imagined it as attempt at creative writing. But while I was studying, I actually started, I mean, journalism changed as well. It became a lot more sort of news-centric. You wouldn't write any more sort of essay-style things for newspapers. It's a little bit back now. But when I started working, journalism was about news and commentary rather than sort of your own free-flowing thoughts. And at one point, I realized that I'm actually interested in foreign policy. I even remember the moment. That was almost 30 years ago. It was in January 1991. when Soviet tanks attacked the TV tower in Vilnius, and I, with a friend from journalism department, we hitchhiked just to see what it's like. We hitchhiked through Riga to Vilnius. We saw the tanks. We saw the barricades. It was a really memorable trip. And I remember on the way there, I was even worried. I suddenly realized that I like it. I like it when something is happening and I go there to see and to communicate what is happening. And it so clashed with my self-image as a future culture journalist, theater critic or something, who was you know, not supposed to be interested in these mundane worldly affairs, but living in the sphere of arts. So I was scared of that feeling. I remember very clearly in that bus from Tartu to Riga. And so I started out as a culture journalist. That was my first job. It was another decisive moment in October of 1993. I was officially on vacation, and we traveled from Estonia to Bulgaria to attend a wedding of a friend of a friend. And we took trains from Tallinn to Moscow, to from Moscow to Ukraine, Moldova, Romania, Bulgaria, and back. And that was a defining moment in so many ways. I saw how these countries were living, and some were living really, really badly. You would see peasants in Ukraine and Moldova desperately trying to sell their product to passengers or passing by trains. And when we got back, we arrived in Moscow in last days of September 1993. And in the middle of Yeltsin's standoff with the parliament, and then my handbag was stolen from me. I lost my passport, and I had to stay in Moscow for slightly longer than I had planned so that consulate could issue me new documents. And in the course of those 2 days I had to stay, all hell broke loose. Insurgents in the parliament broke through, and there were battles next to TV tower in Ostankino and next to the government building. And I went to see both these battles, and that's when I suddenly decided that I want to become a Moscow correspondent. I want to understand how a country gets to the point where its president is shelling its parliament with tanks. And I wanted to understand whether that country was or was not of any danger to mine, to my small, fragile country that was doing so unexpectedly well in comparison to the other ones. So that became my ambition in the course of those few October days in Moscow. And then when I arrived to Tallinn with my newly issued documents that allowed me to return without passport and visa, I just walked straight to the desk of my editor and said, "But listen, now I want to become a Moscow correspondent." But then, of course, it took still a while before it happened, because the paper didn't have money and they probably didn't take me very seriously either. Because who was I, a beginning culture journalist with vague ambitions? How could you trust someone like that to become Moscow correspondent? So it took a short while. I needed to prove myself. But eventually I got there, and I moved to Moscow in 1995.
So it was purely by chance that you discovered your topic. And looking at it now, because you're a very established expert on Russia, you know, for me, it's just such a surprise to learn this story that, you know, you had difficulty establishing yourself, becoming the Moscow correspondent, that with such decisiveness, you dropped what you had viewed for years that will be your topic, to be a journalist in cultural affairs.
Yes. Well, I had always been drawn to Russia somehow, actually. I had always been attracted to Moscow in particular. I remember having some vague ambitions to do something Russia related. My bachelor's thesis actually was somewhat Russia related. But yes, it took a while to realize that foreign policy was my field. as opposed to culture. Even my first experiences in Russia, when I started visiting, I had a chance to visit Moscow quite often because I was friendly with a girl who had Estonian mother and Russian father, and they lived in Moscow. So I had a place where I could stay every now and then. And I would go, but I would mostly go to theaters in the evening, bluffing my way in because it was always sold out and I probably wouldn't have had money for tickets either. So I tried to look important and say I was a theater critic from Estonia. And usually I could get a free ticket and sit somewhere on the stairs. So, yeah, it took a short while before I turned fully to politics. But I think some attraction had been there from the start. And I don't know where that came from. I think it is mysterious sometimes why certain things interest us and other things do not.
It's very interesting also to learn that you're someone who would sneak themselves in a theater.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I got very good at that, and I'm still good at that. I still do it.
In one of her papers, Kadri says that she often entertains herself by thinking, what would Russia look like if Putin had put his ambition and energy into a different direction?
Well, I think that when Yeltsin left and Putin ended the Kremlin, then actually all options were still open for Russia. Yeltsin's time was very chaotic. There were lots of freedoms in Russia, but they never crystallized into a democratic system. And some seeds of managed democracy, so-called, had already started. We could see that during Yeltsin election in 1996 and so forth. But when Putin came into office, all options were still open. And had he put his considerable energy and determination into making Russia a democracy, that Yeltsin was probably incapable of because his personality was more chaotic. He wasn't a systemic and systematic thinker at all, but Putin was. He could have made it a proper democracy, maybe some features of its own, but even so. Had Putin, for instance, when he disrupted the oligarchs' hold over the media, which was not entirely wrong thing to do, because oligarch manipulated Russian media, it was not a healthy thing in the 1990s. Putin was right that these people had their own agenda. So had he, for instance, instead of succumbing everything to Kremlin control, had he tried to introduce something like public broadcasting, then things would have been so much better. Also, had he helped to cultivate the political landscape, that would not have been such a desert it is now. I think Russia could be different, and it would be easier, I think, for Putin to leave. But instead, I don't know whether consciously or instinctively, he helped to build that system that centers around him, where he's the ultimate arbiter. And that makes it very fragile, because by definition, any system that is dependent on a single person is fragile. And it makes it very hard for him to leave now that he's actually tired of his job and one can see it.
Kadri always seems to have such an intimate understanding of Putin. And that shouldn't be a surprise. After all, she did grow up with him professionally. I wanted to know whether, in her opinion, Navalny was a viable alternative, and if she thought she could continue reflecting the successor of Putin the same way as she did with him.
I have once met Navalny in person. We took a group of Europeans to Moscow, and we met also with him. And my takeaway was twofold. I thought that as a person, he was much nicer than I had expected. Because, you know, things were being said about him, that he was a fierce nationalist, xenophobic, etc. And none of that seemed quite true. He came across as a completely normal person when we were discussing. But as politician, he was weaker than I expected. He was, and I guess he still is, a person for one topic. Corruption is his topic. He doesn't really have message going much beyond it or much beyond the obvious. And that, I think, makes it harder for him to make a profound change in Russia. You know, he's, in a paradoxical way, he's part of Putinist system because corruption is part of that system, and corruption might be even the foundation of its system. So Navalny, with his focus on corruption, is also functioning within the paradigm of Putinist system. So I don't know if he has it in him, the ability to redefine and change it profoundly, to shake it up and to give another vision to the country. I am not convinced of that. And also, he might not be someone who can unify people. He has his own followership that is quite well organized, creative, and does lots of things, but that is followership. In order to run a country, you'd need to build coalitions, and I'm not sure how good he would be on that, or who that coalition would even be with, given the desert Russian political landscape is. So, yeah, it could be that Navalny is a wrecking ball to Putin's system, but not necessarily someone who can build up next system. Just like Yeltsin was a wreck the Soviet system, but didn't by himself manage to build anything systematic in its place. And that was left to Putin, who did it in his way. So I do not know, and it could be that change will come from above. That has been Russia's tradition in a way. Most changes have come from above. Gorbachev's perestroika, Khrushchev's fall, Brezhnev's stagnation, whatnot. It's usually come from above. From below, well, Vladimir Lenin came from below, but was that any good? Probably not. So I do not know who will take over, how it will happen, and neither do I know if I can relate to it. Because you are right. I think I have some understanding of Vladimir Putin's way of thinking and logic because we both come from the Soviet Union, not even that far away. Estonia and St. Petersburg are not that far from each other. And I sometimes feel I feel Putin with my skin. I understand what he's thinking. I might be wrong about it, of course, because misunderstanding doesn't mean I can predict his moves. I can explain them in retrospect, but I'm probably not so good in predicting. And sometimes when I'm in the same room with him, I feel there is something about him that I don't understand at all. Something that comes across in person, not when I watch him on telly. But even so, yes, I have been thinking that my Soviet experience gives me some opportunity to explain Putin to other people, maybe sometimes better than some others, but I might not have the same advantage with the next leader. Although I did a couple of years ago research on young generation of Russian diplomats. Well, before that, I thought that, okay, when Putin resigns, my career as a Russia butcher will finish as well. I'm tied to Putin. I need to go when he goes. But after doing that paper, after talking to Rose Young, I'm not so convinced anymore. Maybe there is a life for me as Russia watcher later on as well. We will see.
So it's interesting that you bring this publication up because actually the format is very unorthodox. So basically you did 18 in-depth interviews with upcoming Russian diplomats, and you have several also interesting formats, which are how to talk with Russia and the EU-Russia power audit. But that one in particular with the young diplomats, how did you come across this idea? Do you think it's just your experience or was it something else?
Well, idea actually was not even mine. to start with. I think idea emerged in one of the discussions we had with Ivan Krastev and Fyodor Lukyanov, who both had noticed that Russia's young generation is so different from the old, and the West knows the old Soviet-bred generation of Russian diplomats and their thinking. And they might be completely lost when talking to the younger ones because they have grown up in a different world. Then it took still a long time to figure out how exactly to do it because access was a big issue. We wanted to target people who are already somewhat established in their careers, but for them, talking to a Westerner in a trusting manner was bound to be a complicated question. And I wasn't sure, but people would trust me that I would manage to get information that I wanted out of them. But in the end, it went very well. I realized that actually Russians, that young generation, they wanted to talk. And they are not, you know, they are not simple in any sort of way. They are not pro-Western, they are not Putinist. Their worldview is very complicated and nuanced. And once they saw that someone was genuinely interested and wanted to give them a fair hearing, then actually many of them talked a lot. And to me, it was really very interesting experience. I think the paper itself actually is... Well, it's more like reporting. It's less of analysis. It doesn't include very much in terms of my own thoughts. What I was trying to do was to just show these young Russians to Western audience in all their complexity. And I was really keen to write it so that Russians would read it and not laugh. I didn't want them to think that this paper was another sort of twisted, simplistic Western caricature of Russians, of which there are so many, actually. So editing process was long and painful. I rejected all blunt generalizations that editors sometimes inserted in order to create a bridge from one chapter to the other. I wanted all nuances to be right. And in the end... Yes, in the end, I was happy because the paper came out as it could and should. I felt that if something is wrong, then it's honestly my wrong. Then it is things that I have not understood properly. But it wasn't. I had done my best. I had the way I understood these people had been communicated in the best way we could. And I was actually touched by the reception the paper has found in Russia. Not everyone has unanimously liked it, but they take it seriously. And I think it has prompted even some introspection among younger Russians themselves, because they saw that someone has been thinking about them. Now they are thinking about themselves too. So it's interesting. It was a really great experience to do that.
So you spoke briefly about how you wanted not so much to interfere with your own analysis, but to have more about what the people you interviewed said. So I can tell from here that it's your journalistic side creeping in on your policy writing. And also in general, your publications in terms of style are very different from what you would usually see in, you know, different also from how I write about policy. You have this, it's telling a story, but it's not just telling a story chronologically. It's a bit of a, there's a kind of a fairy tale feeling to it because it starts with some setting of where you've been, what was even the weather like. How did you get to this type of writing?
I don't know. Yeah, I think weather is a good way of starting a story. I know this. I often do it. I do not know if it is always even a good way. I mean, yes, it is true. There is something journalistic in it. I remember we were taught when we studied journalism, our teachers told us that, you know, show, do not tell, do not give judgments, but show what people are like. And that communicates much, much more. Then briefly, I think I did it all the time as a reporter, but there was a time when I think I was actually fairly judgmental in my commentaries. And, you know, I would tell instead of showing, I would tell that Russians are, that Putin is doing bad things and Russians are not, Russia is not democracy and so forth. And I think when I entered the English language debate by joining ECFR, then actually I saw that there was too much of it, finger pointing at Russia and people saying things, and not all of them were said well or not, or even worth saying. So I think I became a lot more self-critical when I started writing in English because, you know, Estonia is a small country and there are not that many people writing about foreign policy. And what I could add to the debate was always of some value in the local context. But English language debate is so big. There are so many people saying so many things that I really started to think, you know, what should I add? What is worth adding? What are the things I could ask other people to pay attention, given, you know, the competition for people's attention? Everyone is writing, but no one can read all of it. So why should people read what I am writing? So I tried to find things to say that were relevant and at the same time somewhat original. I don't think there is a point of sort of saying the same thing everyone is saying just in order to be out there with your name and your articles. I feel good writing when I feel that I have something original to add from my side. And I try to be analytical. I think now increasingly I come back to showing because I think reality deserves to be shown, especially when it comes to Russia, because these days not so many people even go there. They don't know what it is like. And if you come with your analyses, that doesn't necessarily communicate it all. But if I show what's happening, then that might help people more. Somehow, you know, it also resonates with, we have had that debate in a different context in Estonia when we study international relations at university and people are taught to approach it theoretically. You have young students discussing, you know, whether something is realist or constructivist or building up these big theories and then practicing politicians would come and say that, listen, your theory is fine, but you don't know reality. You don't know what happened. You don't know what my conversation with Richard Holbrooke was about. Read memoirs. Read what happened actually in real life. Familiarize yourself with real life and then build up your theory. Don't start from theory without knowing what's out there. And I sometimes feel the same about Russia these days, that you should show what is there and then analyze it as opposed to going the opposite way. And in general, maybe it comes with age as well. Sometimes I feel that real life is actually so much more interesting and so much wealthier than our clever ideas about it.
Well, I was at the ECFR. I visited Russia twice with Kadri. The first time we were in St. Petersburg. And when I arrived there, I was genuinely afraid of getting arrested for no reason. After meeting the Russian experts, I thought that there might be some common ground after all. The second visit was to Moscow. I had gained some confidence, and I expected to be positively surprised by our meetings in the Foreign Ministry and the Duma. I learned that there was no specific plan to disrupt the Western Balkans' integration into the EU. But a meeting with Vyacheslav Nikonov left me filled with anger and outrage. I was convinced there is nothing further to discuss with the Russians ever again. It made me wonder how Kadri manages to be so calm in meetings with Western diplomats who don't want to hear about Russia, and Russian politicians that have made a career out of rattling people's cages.
So maybe I've become calmer over the years. I'm not sure I've always been that, but I think getting angry doesn't really help. And you have always a greater chance of persuading other people when you stay calm and polite and convey your own opinion. That inspires respect. And you should also know what is what, because some of those politicians we met and you referred to, some of them were putting up a show, acting emotional, because that's in Kremlin's agenda on these days and when these topics are concerned. Or sometimes, you know, when it comes to things like Second World War or some history questions, these really are very painful for Russians. She should also try to understand where it comes from. I think that helps to understand. And yeah, I don't think anger really gets you very, very far, which is not to say, of course, that you shouldn't make it clear what you think. There certainly are moments when it's necessary to say that I disagree with what someone else has been saying. Or sometimes it's even you need to define things your own way. You need to say annexation of Crimea as opposed to reunification of Crimea. And then you do it, but you can always do it in a sort of calm and friendly manner.
Going back a bit to your media hat, media has undergone a transformation in the last couple of decades. So first it was the issue of how the medium changed to a digitalized version. And now it's the issue of fake news and also how much of the news actually spreads via traditional outlets, or more to say established, and how much of it spreads on social media. So if you were a journalist now who had to capture the attention and to tell the factological truth, what would be your advice to those people who are trying to do it now? How should they do it?
I'm actually worried about the future of journalism, because I fear that we might soon have sort of two-layered societies when it comes to media consumption. There probably will always be people who will pay for journalism that is solid and fact-checked. You know, the people who subscribe to Financial Times. I do, for instance. I find it's usually good. You get your news and you can trust them, and I'm happy with it. But not everyone has £200+ a year to pay for Financial Times. Many of other people will be at the mercy of what they can pick up for free from the internet. And this news is not necessarily of quality, because the mechanism of survival for news outlets is, for these outlets is different. I'm sometimes afraid whether the landscape will become fragmented or just two-layered, that there is an educated layer of people who consume facts and uneducated who consume rumors. So it wouldn't, and that would be almost medieval, you know, when you had literate people in monasteries who would read manuscripts and write manuscripts, and then there would be simple folks who are not even literate and who survive on gossip and rumors. And that's a wholly different world, and that's not a good basis for democratic society that needs to elect its leaders in more or less informed manner. So yeah, I worry about these developments, but I, at the same time, I think fake news still can be handled if you have trust in a society. And you can see it. I mean, countries like Finland, for instance, where politicians enjoy high level of trust, and society is also fairly small and close-knit, and there is some media literacy that sort of is cultivated consciously. And fake news is not such a big thing there. Or even in say, Estonia. It's a small country. People know one another. When a news story gets out and it seems fake, it is very easy to establish that it is fake. And local media, I mean, public broadcasting and broadsheet papers, they still enjoy sufficient trust to go out and say that, listen, this story is fake. And strangely enough, I mean, that situation is not the case in some countries, such as the UK, where tabloid papers can spread any news they like. And they are never called fake, even though they are. Or they might be called fake, but it doesn't reach their audience. And that has been also my worry when looking at countries like the UK in particular. I think in Europe, it's one of the most prominent examples of that. You know, people discuss Russian influence, Russian interference. Did Russia play a role in Brexit? Was Russian fake news instrumental in Brexit? But it wasn't Russian fake news. It was homegrown, UK-produced fake news that produced Brexit. But the two can exist in symbiosis because, you know, by eroding the concept of truth as such, by not caring about fact-checking, the tabloid press actually prepares ground for foreign-produced fake news. It makes it easier for Russian outlets to penetrate the UK media landscape should they seriously opt to do so. And I don't know how to reverse it because tabloid media in the UK is also a thing that has its own reasons and roots that are not so easily dealt with. So, yeah, I guess it boils down to the statement that it's complicated and worrisome.
Right, that's very true. I've just been thinking about some of the parallels you drew, that it's actually becoming medieval, who has access to what type of information. It's such a paradox with the time we live in that we're actually so technologically advanced. But due to that technological advancement, in part, we're reversing back on something. So yeah, I really hope to see some way that that's been dealt with, because also Bulgaria suffers a lot from this. But I'm looking forward to seeing some programs that address this kind of critical attention towards news sources. So just because we're running out of time and I have the opportunity to ask you one more question, I'll actually ask you two more questions together. One is, if the people in the West had to know one thing about Russia, what would you say that is? And the second one is, what is your advice for upcoming experts on Russia? Let's say people that are just finishing their degrees and getting their first jobs as junior analysts.
Well, I think the second is easier. They should try to go to Russia and see it with their own eyes, because what you can learn about Russia in the West is increasingly black and white, especially as concerns media landscape. But, well, academia is doing sometimes significantly better. There are some very good people in the academia. But even so, go and see it with your own eyes. Develop contacts and invest time. I think it takes years and years to get to know Russia. If you go once, then it's a snapshot of a country. And that snapshot might be adequate for the moment, but you have to see the country in its dynamics, how it develops, what leads to what are the patterns. Some of it you can learn from books and stuff, but some of it you need to experience, I think, and develop a feeling of Russia. And secondly, I think it is good to have open-minded approach, not to try to teach Russia how they need to feel and think. And that's a sin I have committed myself. For much of my sort of time as in Russia as journalist, I was trying to explain how Russia fails to live up to standards of democracy. And that was a way we used to measure Russia at the time. Russia had committed to becoming a democracy, and when it wasn't, and when you felt the need to expose it, which is all sort of understandable and fair enough. But I feel I get more out of place out of Russia when I go with an open mind and try to understand them as they are, without starting at least by putting my own frame on it. And what people should know about Russia, I think it's the same thing, that it is much more complicated and much more interesting and much more likable, actually, than you maybe think. It is not schematic black and white thing, but there are many colors and they all have their own origins. Things have reasons behind it. If there is someone in Russia you do not like who says nasty things to you, but there is a reason why he or she is doing so, and there is reasons may be interesting to explore, although sometimes they are not very interesting at all and very banal. But even that is information for an analyst. So I think Russia deserves a close look with open eyes, and what you see can be sometimes scary, sometimes really ugly, but sometimes amazingly beautiful.
Don't forget to check out our other episodes on Spotify, Google, or Apple Podcasts at The Political Show and Tell. You can also find transcripts of the episodes on our Facebook page.